I want to start with your last line about France, the UK, and India, Vietnam, and Japan also joining in this expansion in naval resources. What's unusual for a great power is that it very rarely asks other countries to arm itself. And I would suspect that the United States does not view the U.S., France, India, Japan as a threat, but looks at those countries as allies to help contain Chinese aggression. And sort of like it's in its previous wars in the Middle East, it's looking for a coalition, a global coalition, to preserve against bad behavior. How should we think about this arms race in its international scope?
Well, first I would say think about it from the point of view of other nations. Not us. We're the big dogs at sea, and we will be for some number of years to come. We don't need to get any bigger and stronger at sea. We just need to respond to specific individual things that the Chinese are doing. But other nations observe us. The United States, we're by far and away the number one nation in the world, and we have by far and away the best Navy in the world. Then they look at China. They're by far and away the number two nation in the world. And what are they doing? They're building both warships and commercial ships at the fastest pace of any nation on Earth. They're building ports. They're installing cranes. So the two big dogs are maintaining strong navies and increasing their global trade. Other nations say, you know what? That's what we should do. We should build a strong navy and increase global trade. So that's what's happening, especially in India, Vietnam, in Japan. Japan is laying the groundwork for building long-range aircraft carriers, something that it has not possessed since World War II. The Royal Navy in the last year has launched its two largest warships ever. This didn't happen in 1943. This happened in 2020. And some of it is desire for naval power to contain is a better word, because we won't control China, but we can contain China. Some of it's a desire for naval power, and some of it's a desire to be able to assure that they can keep sea lanes open and keep global trade happening, because global trade is good for almost everybody, despite what Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders will say. Even almost everybody in the Ohio Valley benefits from global trade. Other nations see this. We're not, certainly not discouraging that, we meaning the United States. We've cooperated, we meaning the United States, actively with India, Australia, and other nations in increasing their naval strength, and we're cooperating actively with Taiwan right now on the same goal.
All right, let's talk about Taiwan next. In the last few days, the Chinese have been sending air sorties into Taiwanese airspace. And clearly, there's some risk now and in the years ahead that the Chinese might plan a large-scale invasion of Taiwan. And the question is, what is the United States and its allies going to do about it? How do you think about that risk? And then we'll kind of get into some detail about how to deal with it from a Navy perspective. But well, there's always technology changes over time. How can the U.S. Navy and the Taiwanese Navy protect itself against an invasion by China?
Well, there's a lot of projects in progress that may or may not work. And my fondest hope is that we'll never find out, because they'll never be tested. But I'll cite one of them for you. 2 years ago, Taiwan started building a fleet of fast reaction mine layers that can mine the approaches to the Taiwan Strait very quickly, like within 24 hours. That fleet is now patched into the U.S. satellite surveillance network. If the Chinese Navy makes a serious move toward Taiwan, the Taiwanese authorities will know about it in time to mine the Strait of Taiwan. And is that enough to discourage China from trying? I hope so, because I hope they never try. But it's something that didn't exist in previous generations, and it's a pretty strong threat to Chinese naval power being used in an aggressive way. It doesn't threaten China's ability to defend itself. And so the kind of weapon that's only defensive is a pretty good type of weapon. But as I say, what would happen if it was used? You may remember that 25 years ago, China started to launch an invasion fleet for Taiwan. the United States, when Bill Clinton was president, put two aircraft, put two supercarrier strike groups in the Strait of Taiwan, and that was the end of that. If we put two supercarrier strike groups to the same place today, would that necessarily be enough to make the Chinese back down? Maybe not. But at the same time, there's never been a great power relationship like today's between the United States and China. I quote a Naval War College professor in the Blue Age as saying, a war between the United States and China, what does victory even look like? If China won the battles, they'd still lose the war because their economy would collapse and their people would rebel. And I think China understands that very clearly, and I think that's the main reason that the United States and China will not fight over Taiwan.
Just thinking about it from the Taiwanese perspective, you know, this is an existential threat to their very society, and so they have more to lose than we do, and so I can imagine a scenario where it may not be in our interest to fight to save Taiwan. The old line, are we willing to give up Los Angeles? The answer is no. So Taiwan will probably have to fight this themselves. In your book, you talk about soft targets. And I'm wondering, you know, once, imagine they mine it, they're doing their best to limit the Chinese ability to land forces in Taiwan. But China has just so many soft targets. I'll just pick a couple. You know, there are chemical plants in China. The Taiwanese could blow them up and create an environmental disaster. They can take, the Chinese are so proud of their high-speed train lines. They could destroy the bridges for those trains. They have dams and other things that they could blow up. They could destroy those super container ships in the ports and destroy all the major ports in China and just eliminate them as an export center. How does China think about their weaknesses and their soft targets in the contest with Taiwan?
In the annals of military affairs, it's common for nations to overestimate their opponents. And I don't even consider China an opponent. I just consider them a competitor. But suppose you were Taiwan, then they would be your opponent. China may look very strong from the outside. It's remarkably weak from the inside. Chinese society is unstable. China is already starting to age out as a society. In 20 years, China will have more retirees than the entire population of the United States. And China is very perilously balanced sociologically on increased food production, which they're doing a great job with. But if anything goes wrong with it, that's going to change. They're very perilously balanced on water supplies. The South-North Aqueduct that the Chinese are almost finished building is the largest and arguably most important public works project in the world. And a few well-placed cruise missiles would flood the whole thing. And I think the Chinese know it, and I think that's another reason that they're going to bluster like crazy to Taiwan. And if they can make a diplomatic agreement to reunite the two Chinas, a diplomatic agreement that was entered into voluntarily, that would be great. But the odds of them starting a war, I think, are pretty low, and for the reasons that you specify, Larry.
You know, historically, great trading partners have gone to war. You know, the UK, France, and Germany have fought for reasons that ex-post look foolish. Why do you suppose that we end up in these long-dated fights? And then, I mean, you've given rational reasons why we shouldn't fight, but oftentimes we do. How do we explain that irrationality of behavior?
Well, I would guess that many of your listeners have read the great book by Barbara Tuchman, The March of Folly, that's about why nations do things that in retrospect seem completely ridiculous. And that the fact that what they're doing is completely ridiculous was actually known at the time. And unfortunately, we can cite examples of that involving the United States and its behavior in Vietnam. If you go back and look at the period just before World War I, Some people would say the strongest argument against my mainly optimistic position is that, well, this was being said before World War I, too, and then look what happened. But in World War I, about 5% of the global economy was based on trade, and less than 10% of Germany's economy was based on trade. Germany could tell itself, it seemed ridiculous in retrospect, but they could tell themselves the things we're going to seize and steal by war are worth more than the loss of trade that we'll inevitably have to overcome. No way China could tell itself that today. No way India could tell itself that. No way the United States could tell itself that. The case for interdependence, another hard word to say, is so much stronger than it was 100 years ago. I'm hoping it will hold. But it is true that nations have behaved in illogical ways in the past. I would say right now the biggest danger is that because China is unstable, as we were just discussing, unstable nations, when they're on the verge of collapse, tend to lash out. There are many examples of that in history. What will happen if the Chinese decide to lash out? Not against us. I don't think they'll be foolish enough to lash out against us, but Vietnam, Malaysia, there's a lot of places on the Pacific Rim that cannot defend themselves against the Chinese military. And then the question will be, do we intercede? I did a call with the U.S. Naval Academy Book Club a few nights ago where one of the questions was, if the Chinese make a serious move toward Taiwan, do we put the fleet between China and Taiwan? And I'm an old washed-up hippie. The thought of recommending war for anybody under any circumstances other than to fight Nazis or communists, any other circumstance, it just gives you the willies to recommend war. But I think we do, and for whatever it's worth, the Naval Academy graduates who were on the call were polled, and 100% of them said we put the fleet between the two countries.
Yeah, that's amazing. I want to talk about technology for a second. In my introduction, I mentioned that in each generation, there's a technological improvement that changes the balance of power or the worthiness of different sorts of strategic approaches to naval war. The carriers, as you mentioned in your book, are quite vulnerable to certain sort of ballistic weapons. During the Falklands conflict, the Argentines used a French anti-ship missile and was able to sink the Sheffield rather easily, even with very advanced weapons. China can invest just a little bit of money in these ballistics, and it puts one of our supercarriers at risk. Do you think on that basis that the Americans will be very wary of putting the carriers within reach of a ballistic missile from the Chinese shore?
Well, this is one of the concerns. Should the United States and China fight in the general area of the South China Sea, will we have to withdraw our carriers far enough away from their land-launched anti-ship missiles, which have a range of a couple of hundred miles? It's possible that that would happen. There's a pretty strong feeling, and I think this feeling is right, that the day of the supercarrier is about to end. We have two more under, the keels have been, hulls have been laid, and two more on the drawing board, and I think they will be the last supercarriers built by any nation. But also bear in mind, no supercarrier has ever been attacked in battle. We assume they're vulnerable. We don't actually know. It might be that they would acquit themselves well. Again, like I hope we'll never find out who would win a fight over Taiwan, I hope we'll never find out whether supercarriers are vulnerable. Any opponent who attacks an American supercarrier would run the risk of a horrific backlash if the attack wasn't totally successful.
You know, just thinking this thing through, you know, when you have aircraft to project forward power, it's much easier to do so on land than it is at sea, because supercarriers have that certain vulnerability. Why wouldn't it make more sense just to land the American fighters at Taiwanese military airports in lieu of maintaining it in the strait?
Well, it's certainly possible that that would happen. One of the beauties of the supercarrier is that it's a moving target. You never know for sure where it's going to be. And if it's in place A, tomorrow it can be in place B. You've got to chase it. Overall, it's, you know, as I say, the day of the supercarrier is ending, and we want it to end in a peaceful, successful way rather than to end as the dreadnoughts that all got sunk at Jutland in 1916. But there is some psychological value also to the ability to project power. I describe in some detail in Blue Age the fact that the United States is the only nation in the history of the world that's ever successfully used a naval strategy called forward deployed, meaning that even in peacetime, your main capital ships, most of them are positioned very far from home, so that the early hours of any kind of fight would involve the good guys attacking the bad guys in their own neighborhood and the bad guys not able to do anything about it in the good guys' neighborhood. And the age of the ability to do that with supercarriers may be ending, but don't forget, supercarriers are only one aspect of American naval power. We have all kinds of submarines whose locations are literally unknown, and they launch all kinds of nasty weapons that aren't nuclear weapons. They launch nuclear weapons, too. But we have four arsenal subs now that used to be nuclear subs that each carry more than 100 cruise missiles. And two of them at any moment are within firing range of China. China does not know where they are. And in the early hours of any serious fight, they would destroy every power station in China. China would not be able to do anything even remotely similar to us. And that's another reason why China will probably never go to war with us.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about naval warfare is that when one power is stronger than the other, it can have total victory. And you gave an example in your book of the violent exchange, the battle between the Bismarck and the Hood. And you said, well, that battle lasted about 5 minutes. And I'm wondering if we could think of it in the same – and as later in both World War I and World War II, the German Navy spent a lot of its time, you know, in its own ports, very nervous and scared to leave for fear of being sunk. Do you suspect that, given the relative strength currently between the U.S. Navy and the Chinese one, that the Chinese will be more like the Germans because of the differential in quality of its the fighting forces, that China would end up being very close to home, very near port or in port, for fear that if it gets out there, it will, you know, face dire consequences?
Well, China has two aircraft carriers. They're both rudimentary by American standards. Neither of them is a nuclear carrier. Neither of them is capable of launching long-range jets. They're both what navalists call ski jump carriers that can only launch short-range aircraft. So they're very uncomfortable to have those ships more than a short distance from home. And the Chinese government would have to know that if our two nations fought today, and I don't think they will, and I hope they never do, but if they fought today, both those aircraft carriers would go to Davy Jones's locker within the first couple of hours of any battle with the United States Navy. And think how, beyond making China weaker, think how the Chinese Communist Party would be embarrassed by that. They've spent 10 years boasting about their rising naval muscle power, and it would sink in a few hours. And they would probably sink something important of ours, too. But it wouldn't happen as fast. It wouldn't happen within sight of their own shores. Think of what a calamity this would be for China if their carriers sunk. And they are building one supercarrier, and boy, I guarantee you that one would be the very first thing that we would wipe out. And they wouldn't be able to defend it. And the good part is that they know all this stuff. And the fact that they know all this stuff discourages war.
So how do we explain their behavior? Why are they describe it as doing two different things? One is, why are they expanding to have this large navy, even though they probably won't be able to use it effectively, and they'll be scared to use it? And second is why be so bellicose with the Taiwanese And is this a needless escalation? Imagine that the Taiwanese responded in kind and started buzzing Shanghai or Beijing with its aircraft. They would go apoplectic, the Chinese. What are they up to here? What is their short and long-term plan?
Well, first I'd say I don't think it's realistic to think that Taiwan could conduct any kind of meaningful strikes on the Chinese homeland. They only have a small number of jets, and their jets basically wouldn't get through. So their military is almost entirely defensive in nature.
Got it.
So why are the Chinese expanding their fleet, and they're adding warships faster than any other nation in the world, even if they're unlikely to fight the United States? Well, actually going to war is only one of the several possible uses of a powerful navy. Think of how we use our navy. Our navy hasn't actually gone to war since the Korean War, and it played only a mild role in that war. There's a psychological component. There's political prestige involved. There's the ability to say, our commercial ships are escorted by one of our destroyers. Don't mess with them. We've done things like that over on the American side. There's the ability to flex your muscles. You send a powerful fleet in the general direction of Taiwan while announcing, don't worry, we're not going to attack you. You might convince the Taiwanese government to enter into peace negotiations. If so, then your fleet has been a huge success without a shot being fired. I describe in The Blue Age a naval exercise in 1992 where the United States Navy sent the most powerful battle fleet that had moved anywhere in the world since World War II directly toward the Soviet Union through the North Sea. And they had no intention of shooting. The Russians knew they had no intention of shooting, but it was a way of saying, look what we can do to you if we've got a mind to do it. And it was one of the things that brought the old Soviet Union to the negotiating table for the eventual agreements that ended the Cold War, and then one of the things that led to the collapse of the old version of communism when the Communist Party of Russia finally accepted that it was just simply impossible for them to overcome United States power. So a Navy can be really useful for all these reasons without any shots fired.
You know, we have obviously many different parts of our armed forces. We've got, you know, the Army, the Air Force, the Marines, and the Navy. And to your point that the Navy really hasn't played a significant role since World War II, where the other branches of our armed forces have been very active, why focus on the Navy relative to investments? You started your whole talk by saying we have lots of budget debates, expert one for more spending in field one, expert two for more spending in field two. And imagine that we replace that with the other members of the Joint Chiefs for the Marines, for the Air Force, for the Army, and the Navy. Why would you want to spend more money or increase your spending in the Navy relative to the other branches of the armed forces?
Oh, well, I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't advocate it. What I advocate is keeping the U.S. Navy strong. I think we should all appreciate how much it benefits almost everybody in the world. It benefits us, sure, but almost all the other nations in the world benefit from the United States Navy being the global police force of the seas. But I don't think their budget should increase. I don't think it's practical. Over the years, the Navy has gotten roughly a third of the Pentagon budget. I don't think I'm okay with that distribution. I don't think the Pentagon budget should increase. I think our military is plenty strong enough, and there are other social concerns, and there's that looming debt out there that the United States, have been printing money like crazy for 20 years without ever triggering higher interest rates. If higher interest rates start, we're going to be real unhappy about all aspects of that. So I think the Navy has to live within its means. When I talked, including to the Academy Book Club a couple of nights ago, they all say we need more ships. Yeah, expert one wants more for his group, expert two wants more for her group, etc. I think they may get more ships in the sense that they get a lot of small distributed autonomous ships. I'd be all in favor of lots of those. But they're going to have to live within their own means when it comes to budget, because really the whole United States government has got to learn to live within its own means. The spending spree cannot go on forever. At some point, it will stop.
We have a question from our audience. This one's from Mike Howe. Mike wants to know, is the naval battles, as you said, if they're finished, should we expect more engagement through aircraft, drones, satellite warfare, et cetera? Where will the next war be fought and how?
Well, I wouldn't claim to have that large a vision, whether to be able to say whether there will be fighting on land again. I spend some time in the Blue Age speculating on why war in general has declined. And one reason, of course, is the end of the Cold War, but that's not the only reason. Satellites make war less likely. If we look at the military past, including the military near past, many battles began because two opponents did not know where each other's forces were, and now everybody knows all the time where everybody else is. And I think that's good. It discourages war. Land is less valuable than it was in the past, even though the population is rising, because you no longer need to seize land to feed your population. Green revolution, high-yield crops can do it. Labor is less valuable than it was in the past. In the military sense, many wars were fought partly for the purpose of seizing slave labor, and now there's really no need to do that to generate wealth. People are still mistreated in many terrible ways, but very few nations are engaged in the expropriation of slave labor anymore, and probably they never will be again. And most importantly, perhaps from the standpoint of whether nations will fight, no primary resource is scarce. And there's no reason to think any primary resource will become scarce in the short term anyway. I mean, who knows what will happen by the end of the century. But for the next 20, 30, 40 years, there's plenty of everything to go around. So why fight? Now, these are all just logical reasons. And as you said, Larry, sometimes folly prevails. But I think fighting on land, fighting in the air, in this century at least, there's only been a couple of major land battles and only one major air battle and no major sea battles. I think that trend is going to continue for all nations.
I have a question that's outside of this area, and you could say you just punt on it. But you mentioned in your opening remarks that our global supply chains are screwed up right now. What do you think is going on? How can we fix it? How do we explain why, you know, a double-digit increase in unexpected trade has really thrown some sand in the gears here, and how do we fix that?
Well, I think the main thing that's going on in the disruption of supply chains is there's plenty of goods available in the world. In fact, the ships that are full of them are parked off Southern California waiting for their turn to unload cargo. The main thing that's going on is that docks are having trouble getting employees, even though they're offering $50 to $60 an hour for unskilled labor. That's why all those ships are parked off the Port of Los Angeles and the Port of Long Beach, because they can't get enough people to do the unloading and then putting them into rail cars. I spend about a third of the Blue Age on the infrastructure of docks around the world, and the first example that I give is the Port of Los Angeles. There's a whole chapter there with interviews of the officials, the management, and labor there, and how the dock functions and so on. And the dock functions in part because people show up for work on time. And in the last year, that hasn't been happening. They've gotten way behind their curve. They're trying to recover in part by offering even more. A couple of days ago, Port of Los Angeles was offering $75 an hour for people with any experience working on a port. And that amount of money is finally drawing out labor. And as labor is drawn out, they'll get those ships unloaded, and then things will mostly go back to normal. At least that's what I would hope. But the port aspect of it has more relevance than you would think. And since almost all of us never see a modern container port, there's no reason why you should even want to see one. We don't appreciate how significant they are. About 10% of California's economy comes from the ports at Los Angeles and next door at Long Beach. And the axiom that I invent in the Blue Age is that any place in the world you go where there's a busy port, the lives of average people are improving. And that's certainly true all throughout the Pacific Rim.
So So I end each episode with a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about, Greg, as it relates to U.S. naval power and global supply chains?
I am optimistic both that the United States and China are not going to fight, and that in general, I can't say everywhere, every time, that the nations of the world are going to spend less on war and more on education and healthcare. Though that last statement, less on war, more on education and healthcare, has been the case every year but one since 1987. We don't sense that or understand that, in part because our media is totally devoted to keeping everything as negative as possible. The New York Times won't report that fact that I just mentioned, although it's a statistical fact and the sources are in the Blue Age, because they don't like that fact because it's not scary and frightening. But that's what's happening worldwide, and I think that's going to continue to happen. Nations will be in competition. Nations will get angry at each other. There's got to be some shots fired in anger somewhere. But in general, nations are going to be more aware that fighting accomplishes nothing and only hurts your own economy. And I contend that the situation is fundamentally different from what it was just before World War I. And yes, it's true, people have said this time it's different before and it hasn't been different. I'm going to double down and say this time it's different. And the arguments are detailed at some length in my book.
Great. Thank you, Greg.